Chapter 4. The Salvage. Surprise kept them silent for a few seconds, even though the young girl was staring at them in anticipation. There was no reason for them to be so shocked by her presence, especially since they journeyed to the planetoid to rescue the survivors of the Lannan. Still, the possibility of survivors after 6 months forced the away team to temper their expectations. Now it appeared their hopes for finding anyone alive bore fruit, and it took some adjustment to come to grips with that. Buck supposed it had to do with the mysterious elements of Lennon's world that left them so off balance. This latest development seemed to be just another peculiar turn in this mission. Buck broke the silence when he reached JD, who was awaiting his commander to take the lead. The ensign was uncertain about the rules regarding the conduct of away teams during a mission and did not want to step on anyone's toes, least of all Buck.
"Hello there, little lady."
Buck greeted the girl with a smile. He noticed she recoiled a little and guessed despite her greeting, she was unsettled by all these strangers in their alien-looking enviro suits. The girl was no more than 16 if that, staring at him hard to see past the glass covering his face. She was probably wondering if they were human. Who could blame her with them in these bulky suits?
"I'm Commander Wilmington of the USS Maverick. We picked up your distress signal."
"Our distress signal? We sent a call for help, but it feels like we've been waiting for so long for someone to come."
"We're here now."
Buck smiled behind his mask. The young lady seemed to have no trouble in the planetoid's strange atmosphere and made him feel somewhat ridiculous trapped in these cumbersome suits.
"This is Ensign Dunn, Lieutenant Pemberton, and Commander Standish."
The girl simply nodded at them, continuing to stare in a mixture of apprehension and wonder. Her ability to breathe in the atmosphere prompted Buck to take a leap of faith and risk taking off his helmet. It was apparent the Lennon's survivors were somewhat traumatized by their lengthy isolation. There was no need to worsen the problem by keeping their rescuers' faces hidden behind these imposing helmets. After all, the atmosphere did trouble young Aislinn, who was just as human as he was.
"Commander, what are you doing?"
Ezra demanded when Buck started to remove his helmet.
"Taking this thing off."
Buck twisted the helmet out of its snap-lock fastenings.
"It's pretty obvious the air's breathable."
"How long have you been here, Aislinn?"
Julia asked as she stepped forward. The girl's attention was very much focused on Buck, and she jumped at hearing a second voice directed at her.
"The ship crashed about 7 months ago,"
she explained, watching Buck with fascination as he removed the helmet. The first officer took an experimental breath of air and seemed satisfied the atmosphere would not poison him before he ran his gloved fingers through his hair, grateful to be free of the headwear.
"What happened to your ship, young lady?"
Ezra inquired.
"We seem to be a little unclear on that point."
"We went through some kind of storm that damaged our hull. Berthold flooded most of the ship."
The admission filled the girl with emotion, and Buck could understand why that was. Berthold rays were hazardous to organic life forms and would likely have killed anyone in contact with it. There was no known cure for the radiation poisoning it inflicted, and Buck was hardly surprised the young girl seemed visibly distressed talking about the event.
"Most of us were killed. There's only a few of us left."
"It's all right."
Buck put a hand on her shoulder to spare Aislinn from explaining further.
"Why don't you show us where the others are, and we can start thinking about getting you off this rock?"
Aislinn immediately broke into a radiant smile, and Buck decided she was a pretty little thing, with her long dark hair almost to the waist, inquisitive brown eyes and full lips. She would be quite a looker in a few years. Her cheeks were a little sunken, but this was likely due to malnourishment. He would not be surprised if she and the other castaways existed on nothing but ration packs since the crash. Judging from the smile on her face, the idea of leaving this imposed exile was a welcome one. He supposed this was hardly the ideal environment for a teenager and wondered what she was doing on a commercial trading ship so far away from the core systems.
"This way,"
she urged them to follow as she slipped through the ship's open hatchway. Buck went ahead, with Ezra following closely. The chief appeared troubled, finding it hard to accept their success in finding survivors so quickly. Then again, Ezra was also a born skeptic, and for a man who believed in Lady Luck to win his games, he was decidedly lacking in faith. The interior of the ship was dimly lit with emergency lighting. Buck assumed the Lennon's reactor core was still functioning but running on minimum power to conserve as much of the ship's resources as possible.
"How many of you are there, Aislinn?"
Buck asked as they started down the narrow passageway that seemed to run throughout the ship's length.
10.
According to the ship's crew manifest, there were 250 of you.
JD,
Julia intervened quickly because she had seen the extent of the hull breaches and knew that level of damage would have caused a substantial part of the ship to become contaminated with Bertold rays.
It's okay, Lieutenant Pemberton. Most of the ship was affected. I was on the bridge with the captain and the senior crew when we ran into the storm. The captain knew I wanted to see the bridge, which was lucky for me, I guess because everyone else.
Her voice drifted away, and it took no feat of genius for the Starfleet officers to guess the fate of the others.
We'll need a skeleton crew from the Maverick if we're going to get this ship off the ground. These old freighters aren't as automated as newer ships, not as much computer memory.
She explained, attempting to move past the subject of the dead crew to avoid causing Aislinn any further distress.
We're going to bring the ship back with us?
Aislinn looked at Buck in question.
I don't see why not. She's taken a beating, but it's not anything that can't be salvaged. Besides, I think your captain might like the idea of saving his ship.
I don't know. I think Captain Kellison is just as sick as we are of this ship. It must be something to travel around in a starship.
Well, you're gonna find out soon enough,
JD remarked.
Yes, very soon.
She smiled. Ezra, trained to analyze people by their body language and by what they try to not show, picked up something in the girl's manner at that statement. Why was he being so suspicious? Ezra had no idea, but her response to JD was not what he expected from a young woman trapped on a ship like this for so many months. The sensation lingered despite his internal arguments, like a bitter aftertaste. For now, however, he filed away his caution, choosing instead to continue his observations. Voices echoed down the corridor from the heart of the ship. As the away team approached the bridge, it was plain to see it had become the main area of occupation for the Lennon's crew. The damage to the rest of the ship had not reached this level since it was surrounded by several other decks. Hearing their footsteps, the Lennon's survivors hurried to meet them, and very soon, the away team found themselves confronted by a ragtag group of people of varying species. Buck identified a mixture of Tellarite, humans, and one Andorian survivor. The effects of their ordeal were easy to see as they appeared just as malnourished as Aislinn. However, while Aislinn had been eager to see them, the adult survivor seemed somewhat reserved and aloof. After 7 months trapped on this barren rock with nothing but the ship's insides as shelter, Buck could very well understand their difficulty coming to grips with the idea of rescue.
Look, Captain.
Aislinn grabbed Buck's hand and towed him towards the portly Tellarite. Her shipmate gaped at the Starfleet personnel along with the rest of his crew in shock and some measure of disbelief. Morale was clearly low after being marooned for so long.
They've come. They've finally come.
The rest of the away team recognized the girl's reaction and hid their amusement, although Ezra couldn't resist a knowing smirk at the adoring smile Aislinn gave their first officer. Julia saw it and nudged him in the ribs gently, her glare warning Ezra he better not embarrass the girl just because she had a little crush on Buck Wilmington.
Don't you dare.
I beg your pardon?
He stared at her with complete innocence.
I have no idea what you mean.
Right.
She snorted before turning to Buck, who was conversing with the Tellarite captain as introductions were made.
How does he do it?
JD whispered in her direction.
The mating instincts of some women can be decidedly askew when it comes to Mr. Wilmington. I hardly see what is so captivating.
Ezra remarked with just a hint of crow in his voice.
You wouldn't. But speaking for the rest of my gender, there are more than a few of us who would not mind us sinking our teeth into Mr. Wilmington.
Ezra turned to her sharply just as she started moving away.
Julia, you are joking, are you not?
Julia winked, choosing not to answer if it meant punishing Ezra just a little bit.
That is hardly funny. I insist, you tell me.
It was a cosmic storm.
Dark Ellison explained after the Starfleet officers and the survivors gathered into the Lennon's conference room. Kellison, like all Tellarites, was stocky and heavyset, with full brown irises and snouts that did not look too dissimilar from the porcine animals of Earth. It became apparent Kellison had kept his people alive through sheer determination and ingenuity. Buck admired the seasoned space veteran for keeping the mortality rate of the survivors steady after the devastating loss of almost 240 people. He couldn't begin to imagine the guilt the man must be feeling and prayed he never found out himself.
We just left one of the colonies on the rim, and were heading back to Lysia and Federation space when it came at us, almost at warp speed. We knew we did not have the speed to escape, so there was little we could do but prepare to bear the brunt of it.
Please take your time,
Buck said gently, seeing the grief in Kellison's face. As someone who considered the crew of his ship his responsibility, he empathized with Captain Kellison and suspected when the survivors were safely on board the Maverick, the man would be spending a great deal of time with Josiah coping with the loss.
Thank you, Commander. It was a level 9 shock wave that went straight through our shields. A starship could have probably taken such impact, but the shields of ADY-500 crumbled like Ferengi Honor. We had multiple breaches all across the hull, as you have probably seen when you approached us.
Yes. I understand that that kind of damage has a tendency to fry circuits on these older ships. Your emergency bulkheads would have probably failed throughout the outer decks.
A human who was the ship's navigator, introduced to them as Janice Owl, responded promptly to spare Kellison the ordeal of explaining further.
We lost almost a third of the crew after the initial impact.
God?
JD whispered. He was still too young to imagine such a loss or the agonizing death the crew suffered. Barrett Old Ray poisoning was meant to destroy tissue on the cellular level and said to be one of the most painful ways to die. The only consolation for those who suffered contamination was the quick death that resulted from such a massive dosage.
It was terrible. Some managed to survive the contamination. It was they who manually sealed the bulkheads in parts of the ship where decompressive purge was able to dissipate the butthole rays.
And how did you come to be on this curious little oasis?
As hard as he tried, Ezra couldn't shake the feeling something about this felt wrong. He wished he could say it started when he came on board the Lennon, but his suspicions existed before they found the ship. He shared the same concerns as Alex Stiles that something about the planetoid did not feel right. However, Ezra was grateful these poor folk survived their ordeal in this lonely half-world. If they discovered nothing else about this planetoid, at least they would be able to rescue the Lennon's crew from their exile.
Well, our warp engines were offline, and with our engineer dead, there was no way to repair it. We were drifting. Lizia was years away and we were without warp engines. Impulse power was down to a minimum and using what was left of our sensor equipment, Janice scanned for a suitable landing site.
Our shield strength was down.
Janice took up the narrative again, directing her answers at Ezra. The security chief wondered if his skepticism was showing because he had no wish to offend these people.
We knew we couldn't make it through the atmosphere of a planet without burning up. And so we were exceedingly lucky this planetoid had breathable air. After we diverted all power to the shields, we managed to make a safe landing, but this meant that once we were on the ground, we couldn't leave.
All that was left to do was to send an automated distress signal and conserve all the power we had left. We had emergency rations for a crew of 250, and everyone even slightly affected by butthole ray contamination soon grew sick and died.
We buried the others at a ridge out there.
The Andorian gazed past them to an unseen place beyond the hull.
It has a beautiful view of the planet. It was the best we could do for them.
I am sorry.
Buck reiterated, unable to think of anything else to say in sympathy that wouldn't sound trite because such a loss was beyond words to salve.
You have nothing to be sorry about. You have found us, and for that, we are grateful. However, I am wondering if it is possible to salvage the Lennon. With the resources of a starship, I am sure that she could be made spaceworthy again. This ship has been our home for almost a year. I would hate to abandon her now that we are free to leave. It just wouldn't be right.
Well, that isn't gonna happen.
Buck was happy to give Kellison some good news on that note.
Lieutenant Pemberton also happens to be the chief engineer of the Maverick and has agreed the Lennon is salvageable.
The Tellarite brightened considerably at this piece of information.
You think she can be repaired?
I do. We have duranium plating on the Maverick, which can be quite effective in temporarily sealing your hull breaches until we reach Deep Space 5. A high-level baryon sweep should be able to decontaminate the decks affected by the Bertold radiation.
Julia smiled, finding the elation of the Lennon's crew infectious.
How long would it take?
Buck asked.
With a full engineering crew and a little help from Mr. Dunn here, I'd say a few days. That is if you don't mind getting your hands dirty doing some real work, Ensign.
The red-haired lieutenant gave the young man a wink of mischief.
I could rough it for a bit, ma'am.
JD grinned, eager to help. He was just as encouraged as the rest of the away team at the joy they would bring to the survivors if they could salvage their ship as well as return them home.
Commander,
Ezra spoke up, taking note of the time.
We need to make our report to the captain. Our hour is almost up.
Yes, we do.
Buck agreed because he knew Chris Larrabee well enough to be confident that if the report they were required to give was not received on time, Chris would tear the planetoid apart trying to learn why. Furthermore, if Chris learned the reason for the absent report was because Buck forgot to deliver it, the captain would be tearing something else when Buck returned to the ship.
Ezra, I think you can do the honors. You and Julia return to the Maverick to round up her team. Let the captain know the situation here is nominal and that JD and I will stay here for now. I don't think it's such a good idea to leave these people alone so soon after finding them, don't you?
Of course not, however.
Ezra hid the fact he disliked the idea of leaving the first officer of the Maverick here alone for even 1 minute, but he was not one to act rashly or make unfounded accusations without proof. The story Kellison told him was perfectly plausible even if Ezra had serious misgivings about this planetoid.
If you do not mind, Commander,
Ezra found himself saying a moment later,
I would prefer to leave my security team here. I am certain they could be invaluable assisting whatever minor repairs the Lennon might require, leaving the engineering crew when they arrived to attend to more important matters.
Julia was about to protest until she noted the serious expression on Ezra's face. While Ezra Standish might be the galaxy's worst judge of where to take a woman on a first date, he was a first-rate chief of security. Whatever his reasons for keeping his security team close to Buck and JD, Julia was not about to question it. Clearing her throat to swallow whatever objection she had, Julia quickly offered her support.
I think that would be a marvelous idea.
All right,
Buck answered, wondering if Julia was still in a snit with Ezra and hoped they'd get over it soon.
You two better get going if we're going to make the captain's deadline.
Ezra flashed Julia a look of thanks as they both complied with Buck's order, hoping he was simply being paranoid and the seemingly dignified manner in which they found these castaways was not a facade concealing something more sinister. Chapter 5. Anger Management. With the news of the away team's safe arrival on the planetoid and the discovery of survivors from the Lennon, the Maverick returned to its regular routine as rescue operations continued. Following Julia's report that the Lennon was indeed salvageable, an engineering team was dispatched to the surface to make the ship space-worthy again. Chris sent Nathan and a medical team to the surface with a wealth of supplies to replenish the resources of the marooned ship during her long isolation. Meanwhile, Vin Tanner found himself seated across Mary Travis inside his quarters for the first lesson in Vulcan disciplines. Until today, Vin had little contact with the protocol officer. This was hardly a surprise since he was not comfortable around women other than Alex, but their science officer was not just any woman to Vin. Most of his friends on the Maverick were the male members of the senior staff, while the women an unknown element Vin was slowly becoming accustomed to. Still, when it came down to it, there was no person he dealt with on a day-to-day basis that made him as nervous as Mary. It was not her fault, of course, and part of the reason he chose to take Josiah's advice and seek her out was that he believed she would not judge his lack of Vulcan knowledge. Initially, he admitted being a little afraid of her, but she gave him little reason for anxiety so far. Vin hoped her empathy for his human side would give him the help he needed to get the psychic side of his Vulcan heritage under control. Mary had brought some objects with her for use during this session, and one of those items included a Vulcan meditation flame. The candle sat on a small but ornate candle holder made of wood and engraved with intricate Vulcan patterns. As the wax began to melt, the candle gave off an aromatic scent he could not place but found strangely soothing. That's probably what it's for, he told himself. As the sweet fragrance filled the room, Vin relaxed, and his discomfort began to bleed slowly away. Taking a few minutes to observe her closely as she prepared the lesson, Vin could understand why the captain was so taken with Mary Travis. Vin sensed it took quite a bit to get past the hardened exterior of Chris Larrabee's heart, and yet Mary had done so easily. She was a lovely woman, with the kind of eyes one could easily become lost in. While he found her enchanting, Vin's preferences lay elsewhere, but he could still appreciate why the captain often did nothing but gaze in her direction when he thought no one was looking.
How are you feeling?
Mary sensed Vin was anxious about this lesson.
Fine,
he said quietly, trying to hide that very thing. Mary probably thought he was an unschooled child, since most Vulcan children would have at least understood the most rudimentary aspect of metal shields.
Ben, it's not that hard. I'm sure you'll learn the disciplines in no time at all.
Vin heard no condescension in her voice, just faith in his ability to master the lessons she would be teaching him. He felt gratified at her belief, even if he didn't think it was going to be so easy.
I hope so. It's been very disturbing.
I can imagine.
When she first married Sion and their marriage bond had been formed, she found it highly disorientating at his ability to read her thoughts almost as soon as she had them. While Mary would become accustomed to the feeling, it had been just as challenging to let Sion into her mind as it was to have free access to his. In the beginning, she thought it invasive until she understood it was part and parcel of Vulcan love. However, for a novice and unbonded male as Vin certainly was, it had to be an ordeal to enter someone else's thoughts without permission or desire.
I wouldn't like it if someone knew what was going on in my head, and I know people wouldn't like it if I was doing it to them.
In truth, he was mainly concerned about displaying such tactics with Alex. Because of his strong emotional attachment to her, he could sense her more clearly than anyone on the ship, save perhaps Chris Larrabee. However, while the bond with the captain was one forged of friendship, the one he unwittingly established with Alex was far deeper and certainly more intense. Furthermore, Vin did not need any clairvoyance to know if Alex even suspected he was reading her. The science officer would be furious, and he did not want Alex angry at him for any reason. She simply meant too much to Vin.
I don't want to invade Alex's thoughts. There's so much there she doesn't want anyone to know.
Do you read her thoughts or just sense feelings from her?
Mary was fascinated by the level of sensitivity she could feel emanating off him. He would have been quite adept if he had trained from childhood.
Mostly feelings,
Vin confessed, thinking even that was too much.
I don't like it. It's like feeling the heat from boiling water. You know it's going to hurt you if you get too close, but you can still see the steam coming at you the closer you get to it.
I see.
Mary nodded, absorbing the imagery to better appreciate what he was telling her.
Well, then we better get started.
Placing both her hands flat on the table with her palms facing upwards, she took a deep breath and raised her eyes to him.
Take my hands.
Vin complied immediately and listened to her soft voice as she began her instruction, secretly praying it was enough. An hour later, Mary did not have to be telepathic to know their progress was less than stellar. No matter how much she tried to teach him the rudimentary basics given to young Vulcan children, Vin had trouble grasping those lessons. His lack of ability deepened his frustration with every new failure. Mary didn't expect him to immediately learn the lessons she was teaching him, since he had never been raised as a Vulcan, but she did wonder if she was doing something wrong. Perhaps Vin needed the tutelage of a true Vulcan master of the craft, but knew Vin would never agree to it. He had enough trouble approaching her, let alone placing himself under the unforgiving scrutiny of a Vulcan teacher.
I can't do it.
He leaned back into the sofa, annoyance oozing from every pore as he let out another groan of exasperation.
It's okay, Ben. You can't expect immediate results.
She did not want him to be discouraged after just 1 hour of trying to learn a discipline that required years to master.
I want to get this thing under control. It's humiliating enough as it is to be so different, to have other Vulcans look at me like I'm some kind of freak. The last thing I need is to start pissing off the humans on board too.
Mary could understand his fears, but she was not about to let him give up on himself.
Din, I'm sure that's not true. Vulcans, don't think that way, and your friends will know that it is not your fault this is happening to you.
Vin let out a deep breath and closed his eyes, trying to focus on the angry emotions running through his mind. He knew he was fast approaching a mindset that would make it impossible for him to learn anything, but Vin could not help it. He felt that at least on some level, he ought to have some understanding of what she was trying to teach him. After all, these lessons were designed for children. It incensed him beyond belief. What was commonplace to Vulcan children was too much for him.
I hate this. I know I'll never really be Vulcan, and I can accept that. It's hard sometimes to want to be a part of something and knowing you never will be, without these abilities ruining what life I've managed to build.
It's not ruined yet. You have a long way to go, but I know you will make it. Real Vulcans.
Mary stopped herself too late when she realized what she had just said.
Real Vulcans?
He glared at her, taking it as poorly as she thought he would.
I am a real Vulcan.
He exclaimed, standing up abruptly.
I just ain't no heartless, unfeeling mechanical machine.
Ben,
Mary tried to say something, anything, to calm down the fire inside his eyes, but he was not listening. Before she could apologize or explain herself, he was halfway across the room and out the door. It was not often Alexandra Stiles saw Vintana angry. When she rounded the corner of the deck and saw him storming towards the turbo lift with an almost visible cloud of rage following him, concern filled her. It took quite a bit to provoke the rage she saw in his face and knew he was not used to experiencing such levels of anger, nor was he accustomed to reining the wild impulses that came with it. Alex did not understand her feelings for Vintana, why she felt this need to protect him. It was just there were times when he seemed so vulnerable he sorely needed someone to give a damn about him. Yet beneath Alex's need to keep Vin safe and guarded against those who would take advantage of his naivete, was an attachment she had not expected to feel for him or anyone else for that matter. Yet ever since that first day in Four Corners, the bond between them was strengthening and evolving into something difficult for either to ignore. While their relationship was hardly sexual, it was highly intimate because it was clear there was more than friendship at work between them. It was this unknown that made Alex and Vin's relationship so special. Although Alex was still too raw inside to admit to feeling anything more than that, she did know he was her friend, and anything upsetting him warranted her immediate attention.
Vin.
Vin turned around slowly, and the look on his face was indeed stormy. What on earth had happened? He was usually so inflappable about everything. Even insults seemed to bounce off him once Vin collected himself enough to react.
What's wrong?
Nothing.
Yet his cobalt-colored eyes said otherwise.
Come on, talk to me, you look pissed.
You wanna know?
He demanded, turning on her.
You really wanna know?
Without giving Alex any warning, he had her neck in his hands and slammed her into the wall. Alex was too stunned to offer any resistance, and Vin was at least four times stronger than her. Before she knew what was happening, his fingers pressed against her cheekbones, and suddenly, her head started to swim as something swept over her, like she'd stepped into a warm shower. Then the black memories came and swallowed her whole. Vin found his hard fist up in a wave of black rage so potent it made the anger inside him pale in comparison. Without hesitation, he penetrated the wall of sheer will, keeping the hateful demons trapped inside of her, and ventured into the fortress where Alexandra Stiles hid her innermost self. As Vin breached that secret place, despair, sorrow, utter degradation and anguish wailed in the shadows. Vin was nearing the heart of something violent, terrible before he realized the act of utter rape he was perpetrating upon her.
Enough.
Alex tore his hand from around her throat and slammed her fist into his face with enough force to drop Vin to the floor. A warm gush of blood oozed from his broken lip as Vin looked up to see the fury in her eyes. His heart sank, and he wished he would die from the shame of what he had just done. His soul screamed inside his chest, and Vin curled up into a ball, aghast he hurt the one person who always seemed to understand, no matter how inexplicable it was for him to explain it to her.
Don't you ever do that again.
The rage coursing through Alex felt barely human. She sensed the anger in him as he attempted to meld with her, and while she empathized with his insecurities, he had no right to do what he had just done. For a few seconds, she stood there shaking, fighting to control her outrage and crush the black emotions into submissions once more. When she composed herself and looked down at Vin, she found the Vulcan on the floor still twisting himself in disgust at his actions. At that moment, Alex understood nothing she said could make him feel any worse than he already did. Seeing him so torn up inside and filled with shame went a considerable way to dousing her anger at him, and once again, Alex felt her heart swell with concern. No one was in the corridor. This was a good thing, Alex thought, because she had no wish to explain what had happened between them to anyone. Feeling her anger abate in the face of his incredible guilt, Alex dropped to her knees to help him up.
Come with me.
Vin raised his eyes to her and the pain she saw in those pools of blue, as well as the intense shame etched in his handsome face, extinguished any lingering hostility she felt. Alex realized she could never stay angry with him for long at that moment. It was a testament to their friendship that she could forgive Vin when she would have torn anyone else apart for such an act of violation.
I'm sorry.
He whispered, clearly horrified with himself.
It's okay.
Alex placed her hand on his cheek, and once again, Vin felt that familiar flutter of excitement whenever she touched him. He loved the feel of her skin against his and would do anything to make it up to her.
You're angry.
She held his gaze as they both rose slowly to their feet.
Yes.
He admitted. Even though he was mortified by his actions, His guilt only served to stoke the fire precipitating his unspeakable behavior in the first place, not quash it. The rage had not disappeared despite his determination to control it. It churned under the skin, bubbling with the need to escape, and Vin realized this was probably why Vulcans chose a life of non-emotion. The alternative was an uncontrollable tide of anger capable of destroying his entire species. Vin understood what an affront he must be to them for the first time. Everything he was had to be a constant reminder of the past they left gratefully behind.
Killer angry?
Vin nodded again, wondering if she was trying to make him suffer by forcing the truth from him. However, there was only that same caring affection in her eyes, which made him feel worse.
Alex, I'm sorry.
It's okay, Vin. I know what it feels like to be so mad you can't stand it. Now come with me, and we'll see if we can't do something about it before you really regret it.
Where are we going?
He hoped it was not to the nearest airlock so she could launch him into space without a suit. Alex and Vin found themselves standing outside Holodeck 1 a few minutes later. His brow furrowed in confusion at what they were doing here, and Alex didn't seem willing to enlighten him as she activated the panel.
Computer. Load Styles Combat Program 21.
Program complete. Enter when ready.
Coming.
Alex entered first, not waiting for him to follow while perfectly confident he would even if confused at her intentions. Good, she thought with a smile. He deserved a little bit of confusion after intruding on her thoughts. While she forgave the trespass on her privacy for what it was, she was not about to let him off the hook so easily. If Vin was so angry he could lash out at one of his commanding officers, Alex knew it was her responsibility, not only as his friend but also as his superior, to do something about it before he actually hurt someone. The world created for them was not what Vin expected. He expected to find an Earth-type environment, but what they stepped into did not look like the planet of Alex's birth. Instead, the skies were red and hot, with molten rivers of heat flowing in the distance while the ground was baked and rocky. For a minute, he thought it might be Vulcan, but the images of his homeworld told him that this place, wherever it was, definitely was not it. Alex saw Vin trying to identify their location and waited until the holodeck doors slid close before she spoke.
It's Corvix.
Vin turned to her sharply with a brow raised.
The Klingon moon?
Yes. Corvix is one of their combat training centers.
Alex relished the heat of the make-believe facsimile of the world on her skin. While the Maverick's climate controls ensured the temperature was never uncomfortable for the thousand people who called it home, Alex sometimes missed the unpredictability of wild weather.
The heat is nice.
Vin enjoyed the warmth. After growing up in a wilderness that was almost tropical in its climate and then later on living in Texas, he found he preferred warm temperatures. Vin never realized that his appreciation for the heat had more to do with his being Vulcan than anywhere Vin might have spent his youth. Unfortunately, as Vin had never been to Vulcan, he did not connect that his home world was one of the warmest planets in the Federation stable.
My father was the Federation ambassador to Kronos when I was growing up.
Alex explained as she took a long look about her and was revisited by memories of happier times. She supposed at some point, she was going to have to speak to William Styles, but their relationship had fractured after her return from Cardassian space.
We lived in the capital until I was 16.
You lived on Kronos?
Vin's eyes widened in surprise. Then again, Alex seldom spoke about her past, and for that matter, neither did he. If he thought to fit in with humans was difficult, he could not imagine what a human female must have endured being surrounded by Klingon warriors.
It wasn't so bad. I learned how to deal with anger quite effectively thanks to the Klingons.
She guessed what was on his mind and then addressed the computer again.
Computer, adjust safety protocols to maximum tolerance and produce 2 batleths.
You're kidding.
Vin exclaimed as the weapons materialized before the 2 Starfleet officers and Alex walked towards them.
What's the matter, Lieutenant? Scared I'll hurt you?
She leaned down and picked up the curved blade before handing one to him.
No.
Something he could not define bubbled inside him at the idea of meeting her in combat. If Vin did not know better, he would say it was excitement, and had it been remotely possible, it could have even been arousal.
I'd hurt you,
he stated, trying not to come out and remind her as a Vulcan, he was more than a match for her.
I know you're a lot stronger than I am. However, I train to use these things with Klingon opponents, and I've managed to hold my own, so if I were you, I wouldn't be so sure that you're going to beat me.
Alex.
Vin started to protest, genuinely believing he would hurt her if they fought, despite the stirrings of desire fed by the possibility of what she was suggesting. He was still trying to convince himself this was a bad idea when suddenly, Alex swung the blade into a neat arc, heading straight for his skull. Without thinking, he turned his own batleth to block the strike.
Heads up,
Alex warned once the clanging of metal faded away after the first blow was struck.
You could have taken my head off.
Vin protested as their batleths met again, metal against metal, clashing loudly with each blow.
Of course not. I wouldn't do anything to that pretty face of yours.
She winked and took the stance to strike once again.
Pretty, huh?
Vin frowned and swung the blade again, once again countering a very skilled move by Alex, which told him he had better start paying attention or he was going to get his ass effectively kicked.
I'll show you pretty.
Chapter 6. Holodeck Fun. Mary hoped staring at the vast expanse of stars beyond the plexiglass window of Four Corners would make her problems with Vin Tanner seem insignificant. Perhaps they might provide her with a solution for proceeding with their next lesson. Despite the breathtaking vista of a yellow sun against the canvas of glittering stars, no answer was forthcoming. She questioned if the task of teaching Vin all things Vulcan was within her ability. Mary hated admitting defeat in anything, but she was dealing with a very fragile psyche. Vin had enough trouble coping with his Vulcan heritage without her pointing it out to him the way she had this morning. Following the ugly scene in his quarters, Mary had no choice but to leave the room, scolding herself repeatedly at how she could have made such a comment. He felt enough of a pariah among the Vulcans on the ship without her setting him apart even further. Her insensitivity mortified her. She wasn't blind for how much courage it took for Vin to approach her for help, and he was right about Vulcan attitudes towards him. As much as Mary wanted to believe other Vulcans could readily accept Vin, Mary knew it was problematic. He was a throwback to a past they abandoned centuries ago, and his embrace of the emotions they denied was hard for them to accept. Letting out a deep breath as she stirred her cup of chamomile tea for the umpteenth time, Mary confessed her enjoyment of being among humans again. While Vulcan tradition was very secure at times, she missed the unpredictability of human behavior. She still missed Sion and their life together, but Mary could not deny that being on the Maverick was what she sorely needed after his death. Of course, the restoration of her humanity had much to do with the master of this vessel. He was the black hole at which she stared fascinated but unprepared to enter just yet. She cared for Captain Chris Larrabee greatly, and his affection was clear to anyone who saw them together. She felt a stronger connection to him than anything she felt for Sion, prompting her guilt. Sion had been her husband and the father of her child, yet the bond with Chris was more profound than the one produced by 8 years of marriage. Around Chris, the mercurial after effects of living in a world of passionless logic seemed to melt away. Mary could feel the heat of human desire wafting through her mind with its heady scent. Chris's willingness to wait for her to come to him, aware Sion was too fresh in her heart to supplant, touched Mary. They shared a comfortable relationship edging towards something far more intimate, but he was not pushing. At this time, they existed in that limbo between friendship and love. Whenever there were social functions, she was always at his arm, and he was a frequent visitor to her quarters to share dinner with Billy and herself. Then there were their weekly chess games where they would sit across each other, secretly studying every sparkle in each other's eyes. Part of a why she was so determined to help Vin had to do with Chris. Buck Wilmington may have been Chris's oldest friend and his first officer, but the helmsman was the captain's best friend. Chris kept his professional relationship with Vin Tanner entirely separate from his personal one. They spent their off-duty hours together on the holodeck. During shore leave, they engaged in some other dangerous pursuit that would see them risking life and limb. What affected Vin would ultimately affect Chris, which made Mary more determined to assist the Vulcan.
You seem like a woman with a problem.
A voice interrupted her ruminations, and she looked up into the kind face of Counselor Josiah Sanchez. Mary sighed loudly, concealing nothing.
I am.
Mary knew Josiah by reputation even before she arrived on the Maverick and met the famous psychiatrist in person. Josiah had more or less written the book on interspecies relations for the last 20 years. His paper in Human Klingon Interaction was still required reading at Starfleet Academy. On a personal level, he was ideally suited for what he did and possessed a soft, calming voice capable of soothing even the most troubled soul. While Mary had yet to find any reason to consult him professionally, She did like talking to him and found he often had interesting insights into whatever difficulty she was facing. Josiah sent the Vulcan to see her because he believed she could help the young man. After their session today, Mary wondered if Josiah had heard since Mary only made things worse.
Join me?
You do have the best seat in the house,
Josiah remarked, indicating the view before he nestled himself comfortably on the seat with a cup of coffee in hand.
I was hoping it would offer me a little insight.
I take it things are not progressing well with Vin.
Mary straightened up and gave him a look.
I thought it was your wife who was the Betazoid.
Josiah grinned and nodded.
She was. I'm just naturally gifted.
Mary chuckled softly before her expression changed into something a little more somber.
I messed up, Josiah. I was trying so hard to show him he could be Vulcan that I forgot the whole point of the exercise.
It happens,
Josiah said with no reproach in his voice.
It's not easy dealing with Vin. There are times when he seems very at ease with who he is, and then there are other moments when something crops up he is unprepared to face. It shakes that security to the core.
Are we speaking from personal experience?
Mary looked at him with a raised brow as she sipped her tea and found the aroma of chamomile almost as soothing as Josiah's presence.
Every person is different.
Josiah was unprepared to reveal any more about his sessions with Vin than necessary, beyond what she needed to know.
Vin has spent a lot of time alone. He lost his biological parents when he was 5 years old. That's extremely young for any child. Federation authorities attempted to trace his family through the Vulcan registry. Only the ship bringing him back developed engine troubles en route to Federation space. It was marooned on an undeveloped M-class planet for almost 12 years. The last 5 of those years were experienced alone because his foster parents did not survive the harsh environment. Being Vulcan and at his age, he was stronger and more capable of surviving the terrain, but it left him socially undeveloped. Vin knows how he feels about things as well as understanding other Vulcans may never accept him.
That's a hard pill to swallow. Most people couldn't.
He manages because he has friends and because he refuses to let any situation get the better of him. When he's upset, he withdraws and deals with it on his own, but he has little experience coping with anger. After suppressing the hurt for as long as he has, it becomes tough to cope when it fails.
And it's worse when his abilities overtake him because he has no experience with it, and there is no Vulcan about to help him. Except me.
Except you,
Josiah declared.
You are the closest thing to being someone he can approach for all his questions. At this point, we're not even sure how old he is, so Ponfar could come about any time, and he won't have the slightest clue what will happen to him.
As the wife of a Vulcan, she was perfectly aware of what Ponfar was and how dangerous it would be for Vin.
That is worrying. Normally Vulcans would be bonded to a mate at a young age to prepare for that time, but if it happens to Vin and there is no mate prepared for him, it could be exceedingly bad.
Deadly, if I'm not mistaken,
Josiah added.
You're trying to make him comfortable enough with me to bring up Ponfar and anything else like this, aren't you?
Mary guessed, having played negotiator enough times to have a little bit of insight herself. Josiah eased into his seat and shrugged.
Guilty.
You are wasted in psychiatry. You should be in espionage, but I thought Alex would be more appropriate. They have a closer relationship.
They do,
Josiah agreed.
But no one has the insight you do into Vulcan traditions, and the dynamics of his relationship with Alex is completely different. I think we both know why.
Yes, we do. I'm willing to help Vin in any way, but I just don't know whether I will cause him more harm. Our first session today was disastrous. I kept trying to teach him things that even Vulcan children should know.
I understand what you were trying to do, Mary,
he interrupted gently.
However, you have to remember that to Vin, being Vulcan is the reason his ears aren't like anybody else's, and that's all the connection he has to it. For most of his life, he's been raised as a human. He thinks like a human being, and he sure as hell feels like one.
And suddenly, Mary understood.
I've been a fool.
I wouldn't put it that way,
Josiah replied warmly, pleased she could finally see a way to help Vin.
I would. I, of all people, should have known the way to teach him was not to teach him like a Vulcan but like a human. Like how I was taught.
I won't argue with you there,
Josiah agreed.
Your husband taught you about shields and mental disciplines even though you didn't have the slightest bit of understanding, but you managed.
And if I can manage without any ability at all, then Vin, who has the natural ability, should be able to handle it with no problems.
Lieutenant Travis, you're a natural.
Mary rolled her eyes.
Let's just reserve judgment and see if he stays for the whole lesson this time.
Despite the linen's smooth repairs down on the planetoid, Chris begrudgingly admitted something was unsettling about the whole situation. While he could not for the life of him pinpoint why he felt ill at ease how there could be any survivors at all, he knew that much of it had to do with the planetoid being an impossibility in every sense. As Alex reminded him on numerous occasions, nothing about the small asteroid presently held in place beyond the planet's orbit adhered to the laws of physics as they knew it. There should be no atmosphere on the surface, and yet there was. While cosmic storms were known to happen, Chris never heard of one being severe enough to wipe out a crew of almost 250 people, and yet it must have occurred because the evidence was right before them. The more they learned about Lennon, the more questions he had.
"Ezra, how long until Buck has to make his report?"
Chris asked, studying the contents of the datapad. Beside him, Yeom and Casey Wells waited for him patiently to complete the idiocies of bureaucracy not even a starship captain could escape. Meanwhile, she stole coy glances at the communication and navigation station. The young Bajoran was trying to hide her interest in J.D. Dunn, but just about everyone on the ship knew the duo was courting in a very tentative romance.
"According to his last scheduled communications with us, approximately 1 hour."
"Have we been given any indication on how long these repairs are going to continue, Alex?"
Chris asked the second officer. Alex continued her attempts to penetrate the cloak surrounding the planetoid that deflected all their scans. Chris knew Alex liked it even less than he did that the mystery of the Lennon's world remained unsolved.
"According to Julia, another 2 days. The outer hull took a severe beating, and the engineering crew is attempting to seal all the punctures."
"Perhaps it would be prudent if we just removed the survivors and returned for the Lennon at a later date,"
Ezra suggested.
"With more specialized scanning equipment,"
Alex added under her breath. Chris saw Vin turn around, and both men offered each other a knowing smile before Chris remarked.
"You two are a breath of optimism, aren't you?"
"I just don't like anything I can't understand,"
Alex spoke up in her defense, aware the captain and his helmsman did not share her suspicion about the planetoid as intensely as she and Ezra.
"Well, everything about this planetoid must qualify then."
Chris conceded that much.
"Of course, if you let me down there, I'm sure I could sort things out in a minute."
Chris swiveled about in his chair and met her innocent expression with one of his own, indicating he was perfectly aware of what Alex was doing and was not falling for it for a minute.
"I don't think so, Commander. I need you here in case the crap hits the fan."
"That was charmingly put, sir,"
Ezra frowned.
In the meantime,
Chris changed the subject for a lighter topic.
"Maybe you show us how you kicked Vin's ass in the holodeck."
Vin let out a visible groan and looked at his captain.
"Does everyone know about that?"
"He claims he let me win."
Alex flashed Vin a playful smirk which he returned with one of his own, laced with annoyance.
"I am the captain, Vin,"
Chris chuckled, enjoying the helmsman's chagrin immensely and almost wished he had been present to see Alex and Vin battling it out on the holodeck with a pair of batleths.
"When one of my officers hobbles into sickbay with several injuries, the chief of staff usually lets me know."
"Nathan has a big mouth,"
Vin grumbled.
"Actually,"
Ezra cleared his throat and looked at Alex.
"If you two should wish to consider a rematch in the near future, would appreciate it if you were to let me know. I am certain that there are individuals on board who would be quite curious to see which of you emerges the victor."
"For the uninformed,"
Chris spoke up,
"that means he wants to lay bets on the outcome."
"I guessed."
Alex gave the security chief a look. Ezra offered her a grin, showing no signs of repentance at the captain revealing his true intentions.
"Well, there's just so little to occupy our time here. I thought I might boost morale a little."
"Forget it,"
Vin said firmly.
"I've just lost my dignity. I don't need to help anyone else lose their money as well."
"Chicken,"
Alex said smugly, engendering a tiny ripple of laughter throughout the bridge. Vin looked over his shoulder at the science officer and remarked sarcastically,
"I'm gonna make you pay for that next time, and it just so happens I did let you win."
"I'm sure you did,"
Chris said with a perfectly straight face.
"Thanks a lot, Chris. I'll remember that the next time you're dangling off the side of a mountain and need a hand up."
"I have no idea how you two can find that recreational."
Ezra shook his head, unable to imagine how climbing mountains and indulging in all kinds of dangerous activities could be considered fun. Leisure sport resulting in broken limbs or worse seemed more trouble than it was worth.
"I think I rather prefer Mr. Wilmington's latest holodeck simulation of the Old West."
"You mean the one where you men play cowboys?"
Alex wondered if there could be anything more indicative of human males than the need to play cowboys and Indians.
"I am not a cowboy."
Chris looked over his shoulder from his command chair and gave her a somewhat pointed glare.
"The correct term is gunslinger."
You like it because you're a smooth-talking gambler,
Vin pointed out to Ezra.
And tell me you do not love being the wild and woolly tracker?
Ezra returned just as sarcastically.
What about you, Captain?
Alex heard of the program but had no desire to participate. A woman trapped in the 19th century seemed like a most unpleasant place to be.
What part do you play?
Oh, the captain plays the mysterious man in black.
Casey offered, glad to have something to contribute to this conversation.
You've taken part in this, Casey?
Alex was somewhat surprised the young Bajoran would partake of an adventure and a time so alien from her own.
Yes, I'm the plucky and capable tomboy who hangs around town sometimes.
Perhaps you ought to join us,
Ezra suggested, thinking Alex would look delicious in the costume of the period, and for that matter, so would Julia. Ezra reminded himself to bring up the subject with the lady when he saw her again. In either case, the rough-and-tumble simulation of the Old West could not possibly be as offensive to her as the infamous Caesar's Palace.
Not on your life. I can't abide getting into all those corsets and petticoats. Not to mention, standing by and looking pretty while you men save the day.
It's not that sexist. Chris defended the simulation even though he could not deny it was not entirely friendly towards the ladies, but that was the sentiment of the day. He could hardly be blamed for playing the program in its proper historical context. Besides, I think you'd be right at home looking pretty. Chris gave her a schoolboy grin, knowing she would just hate the concept of being clad in lengthy skirts and confining hairstyles. The science officer rolled her eyes, deciding she was washing her hands of them.
Men.
An hour later, Buck Wilmington made his schedule report to the Maverick. Chris was glad to see his first officer well and once again bristled in annoyance at the technical difficulties requiring Buck to be in orbit before he could deliver his report. For the most part, Buck seemed quite relaxed on the viewscreen, and his account was somewhat non-eventful. Julia told us that the repairs will take another 2 days, Chris stated as he looked at Buck on the large screen in front of the bridge.
That's right, most of the circuitry in their engine core was fried in the storm. Julia's got the engineering crew working round the clock to repair what they can and replace the rest. By the way, Ezra, your security team is doing a great job helping out with getting the breaches sealed.
I'm glad,
Ezra answered automatically. However, there was enough tension in his voice to reveal to those paying attention he didn't like his security team getting so caught up in the repairs they forgot why he left them down there in the first place. Ezra wanted them on the planetoid to keep an eye on things, not just to act as extra hands.
Captain, Dr. Jackson has made another request to start sending some of the survivors up to the Maverick for full medical evaluation.
It was not an unreasonable request as far as Chris was concerned, and one which the captain felt should have been taken care of immediately. While the med team conducted preliminary scans on the planetoid, it could not replace the necessity of completing the evaluations on board the Maverick. Buck, Chris regarded his first officer on the screen.
Nathan wants to have a look at the survivors and give them an examination. Tell them we want them on board the Maverick.
They're pretty reluctant to leave the Lennon, Chris.
Buck explained since this request from the doctor was nothing new.
Now that it looks like we might be able to salvage her, they're determined to help as much as they can with the repairs.
That's very commendable.
Chris wanted no more delays in this matter since he had heard enough excuses already.
But this is not a request. I want those people to see Nathan soon.
Yes, Captain.
Buck understood completely.
I'll relay it to them and get them ready to come aboard for our next supply run.
All right, talk to you at your next scheduled report.
Chris gestured at Ezra to terminate the signal since they were done for now. There was a pause of a few seconds after Ezra cut communications before he looked at Chris and remarked.
Captain, is it me? Or are those people somewhat reluctant to leave that planetoid considering they were trapped there for all this time?
Chris nodded in agreement, finding it just as suspicious as his security officer. It was increasingly bothering him more than he liked to admit. His people were down there with individuals they could not scan to verify if they were who they seemed. Their reluctance to see Nathan made him more suspicious.
It isn't you.
Chris continued staring at the screen even though there was nothing further to see.
Request permission to go down there, sir.
Ezra asked again because that bad feeling so often accurate was pressing against his spine with insistence. This time, Chris had no objections.
Granted, Commander. Get down there and find out what's going on.